thanks very much for joining me again. I'm James Curran. I'm Professor of Modern History here at Sydney University and also the International Editor at the Australian Financial Review, where I write regularly about Australia in world affairs. Now, last episode, I talked about how the key concepts of nation-state, mass nationalism, and utopian internationalism, which have been used to make sense of international relations, emerged out of European history. And in the process, I also attempted to show the problems involved in the theories of international relations to which they're connected. Now, in these next two episodes, I want to be talking to you about how these concepts have affected Australian attitudes and policies towards the world. I want to look at the historical background to Australia's foreign policy and to see what degree there is continuity or discontinuity in Australia's perception of the world. And I also want to look at to what degree a pattern of attitudes and policies from the past still influence Australia's response to the contemporary world. So today I'm going to speak about the Australian response to the age of mass nationalism. I want to look at how the Europeans who settled the country and created the foundations of modern Australia defined themselves and thereby culturally and ideologically connected themselves to the world. So, how did they come to see themselves as a community of culture, as a people sharing a common culture? And in my next episode, I'm going to look with you at how they took on the role of a nation state, how they defined their national interests, especially those arising out of their geographical position, and how they developed foreign and defence policies to protect those interests. So when you hear me next, in the next episode, I'm going to look at Australia as a community of interest, as a people sharing common interests. Let me start with this idea about how Australians in this era came to define themselves as a community of culture. Now, I'm going to do two things here. I'm going to explain what I mean by mass nationalism, and then I'm going to look at how that took the form of Britishness in Australia and how that helped Australia to perceive Asia in racial terms. Now, you will have noticed that when I introduced this topic, I said what I wanted to do was to show how Australia responded to the age of mass nationalism. I didn't say that I would discuss the nature of Australian nationalism. And I describe the topic in this way for a purpose. And this purpose is related to the debate over the concept of nationalism and how it might be understood. We need, basically, to look at how Australians originally define themselves as a people. Now, granted, this might strike us now as a bit confusing. In other words, why ask this question? I mean, aren't we simply Australians? I mean, there is a conventional wisdom that Australia has always exhibited a weak sense of nationalism, or that we've shown other nations how to be a nation without a nationalism. But is that accurate? That's the question. The concept of nationalism holds that people have fixed or permanent or essential national identities. That is, nationalism claims that people who define themselves in nationalist terms have from the beginning of time belonged to the same stock, spoken the same language, shared the same customs and culture, and that indeed all history has been about the struggle of all these different peoples to throw off foreign masters, unite with all those who share the same identity, and so ultimately fulfill their historic destiny and realise their nationhood. Now, that is certainly how the great Western nationalist historians of the 19th and early 20th century told the story of their peoples. In recent times, however, scholars, especially Benedict Anderson, have questioned this view. Now, Anderson treats nations as what he calls cultural artifacts. He understands them as imagined communities, and he regards nations as an idea of social identity that arises out of a particular set of social circumstances at a particular time in history. Now, this new way of understanding nationalism has been very influential, and the title of Anderson's book on this subject, Imagined Communities, has become something of a commonplace in the contemporary literature on the subject. And indeed, the word imagining keeps cropping up in all kinds of studies of the nation and nationalism. Now, what Anderson is saying is that nationalism is not, as nationalism itself claims, natural. It's not an idea of social identity or belonging that's there from the beginning of time. Rather, it's socially constructed and historically contingent. So, it came to be articulated and adopted at a particular time in response to a particular set of circumstances. Now, of course, it may be that in most cases, The national myth or imagined idea of the nation drew on legends or symbols, rites and customs which had already existed. But in the nationalist era, they were remade and given a new religious significance. You'll recall that in my last episode, I spoke about the pre-modern era when inferiors owed allegiance to social superiors, whether kings, princes or lords. But now, in the nationalist era, individual citizens owed allegiance to the people, that is, to themselves. It was in every sense a much more powerful source of identity than that which it replaced. And as a result, nationalism was a social identity for which people were willing to die, to give their all. Now, what were the circumstances which gave rise to nationalism? The answer would seem to be the onset of modernisation, which first occurred in Europe and America. The great social changes of industrialisation, urbanisation and mass migration destroyed traditional communities and loyalties and created a need for new social identities. In traditional societies, people's sense of self was generally related to their local community. They inhabited a relatively static world. Their idea of social belonging and welfare was connected to villages and localities with which their families had long established ties. Most inherited their social position in every respect: occupation, lands, houses, professions, status. They inherited their neighbours and their loyalties. They pledged fealty to their liege lord or monarch. But what Anderson is saying is that modernisation brought about a revolution in social psychology. So in leaving their traditional homes and lives, individuals began a process of physical and psychological migration. In the great industrial and commercial cities, they had to find a new way of connecting to society. And old ties, including often the wider family ties, were left behind. Individuals had to find their own salvation in this modernising world of constant change. But that process was deeply disturbing. Those affected by it had lost their social anchors. They'd lost the seemingly timeless world which they had known personally and which had given to them a fixed and certain place in society. And now they were bobbing around out in the new modernising world like atom-like individuals in an ever-changing mass society. How could they find for themselves new social identities and loyalties which could bind them to and give them security in this modern world? Here is a great trauma, right, in this transitional epoch. A psychological one, a social one. And individuals needed an intense collective identity, one which they could carry with them wherever they might roam. Now, in Europe, where the modernisation process began, the two strongest ideas which appeared to meet this need were mass nationalism and international socialism. The cry of the latter was Karl Marx's cry:
workers of the world, unite!
And international socialist organisations emerged at the end of the 19th century for this very purpose. That is, Marx was telling those who were most disturbed and most alienated by the modernising process, namely industrial workers, that the society to which they belonged and which would make them whole was that of the worldwide community of the proletariat of international socialism. But it was not international socialism, but mass nationalism which won the day. The idea of belonging to a people who shared a common race and culture had more powerful emotional resonance than that of the common suffering shared by the workers of the world. Moreover, nationalism was more appealing in that its myths about national origins, which idealised forest tribes and yeoman farmers, helped connect the modern person to the values and ideals of the past they had lost. Nationalism had an emotional power that socialism could not match. And as I pointed out in a previous episode, it's worth noting that in the era of mass nationalism, European publicists and politicians, to indicate the absolutism and exclusivism of this new identity, often described their respective peoples in a quasi-biological way as belonging to the German race, the French race, or the British race. So how did Australia and Australians respond to this age of nationalism is the critical question. Remember that by the end of the 19th century, this process of modernisation was at full bore around the world, especially in Europe. The Australian colonies were probably the most urbanised country in the world, and they were probably also the most egalitarian democracies, where universal suffrage gave a direct meaning to popular sovereignty. And it would appear that the Australians responded with great enthusiasm to the appeal of nationalism, possibly even with greater enthusiasm than the people of the United Kingdom. Since 90% or more of the colonists who migrated to Australia in the 19th century came from the British Isles, they adopted with hardly any debate or resistance what might be called a British race myth, which linked them to all other white peoples in the empire. Earlier 19th century liberal movements which had called for a republic and independence moved to the margins of political life. Indeed, ideas of liberty under law and parliamentary government were incorporated into the British myth. That is, they were seen as part of the genius of what was called the British race. It was thought that other races were not able to understand British liberty or appreciate parliamentary government. In 1878, at the beginning of this nationalist era, when Peter McCormack wrote the words to Advance Australia Fair, which since 1984 has become Australia's national anthem, replacing God Save the Queen, McCormack did this to celebrate Australians' distinctive character as a British people. In a stanza that was subsequently excised from the sanitised version of the post-British era, McCormack proclaimed that
Britannia then shall surely know, beyond wide ocean's rolls, her sons in fair Australia's land still keep a British soul.
So you can understand why in 1984, when the Hawke government rewrote the national anthem, they got the bureaucratic scissors out and cut that paragraph out altogether. Because behind our present national anthem, there lurks the ghost of a British past. In the era in which McCormack was writing, nations were given a quasi-religious status. Nations, alone of all social organisations, had souls. Australia had a British soul. There was no alternative in the field. The supposed heroes of a would-be latter-day unique Australian national myth, such as the poets of the bush legend Henry Lawson and Banjo Paterson, all had feet of British clay. So Australia's experience of nationalism is very different from France or Germany or the United States. In one sense, it might seem very strange that Australia should have a national myth, which had its centre not in the land which the Australian people inhabited, but in a people who lived at the other end of the globe. Nationalism, after all, says that all self-respecting people ought to have a unique myth of their own. What the historian Neville Meaney and others are arguing is that when you free yourself from the hegemony of nationalism and its own view of identity, from what nationalism wants you to believe, which is that it's there from the very beginning, when you free yourself from that and you see nationalism in Benedict Anderson's terms as something that's socially constructed, appearing at a particular time in history, then it should not upset or trouble Australians a day to accept that Britishness was at the core of what might be called Australia's community of culture, and that this was the case basically down to the end of the 1960s. Now, let me illustrate to you the strength and extent of this Australian Britishness in the nationalist era. Let me give you a few telling examples of the way that Australians define themselves as a people at this time. Let's begin with Sir Henry Parkes, the Premier of New South Wales, the father of Australian Federation, as he's so commonly known. Speaking at the opening of Centennial Park on the occasion of the centenary of British colonisation, Parkes declared,
"Hope that the red line of kinship will unite us to England for generations to come. I trust year by year that Britons all over the world will carry their great national flag and the cause of progress, until there is no spot on the earth where British freedom does not reign and where our flag does not fly."
Growing even more grandiloquent about the future of the Anglo-Saxon race, as the British idea was often called, he went on to incorporate the United States into his vision of the race's destiny.
"I want no separation. I trust the day is coming when instead of separation, these great states that are forming here will hold out their hands to the states of America, and these two great countries will stretch their hands again to the mother country, and will unite one and all in one great empire to govern the world."
How prescient, some might say, was Parkes talking about the future AUKUS agreement on nuclear-powered submarines? My God. Will the first submarine to be delivered to Australia be called the SSN Henry? I'll leave that for others to decide. Perhaps the clearest expressions of Australia's Britishness came to the fore at the time of the Empire's Wars. It is wars against other peoples, other nationalities, that brings out most sharply the meaning of one's own nationalism. And Australians in joining in all of Britain's wars down to the 1950s showed that they did indeed have British souls. At the time of Britain's war against the Boers in South Africa in 1899 to 1902, Australians expressed great enthusiasm for the Empire's cause. All the Australian colonies and then the new Commonwealth, which came into being in 1901, sent contingents to support the Empire. Edmund Barton, who was leader of the Federation movement, was to become the first Prime Minister of the Commonwealth, explained the Australians' response by saying that they were for the Empire, right or wrong. That is the classic expression of nationalism when faced with an external enemy. At the outbreak of World War I, Australians were in the midst of a federal election and the leaders of the Labor and Liberal parties vied with each other to prove their loyalty to the Empire's cause. Andrew Fisher, the Labor leader who won the election, promised that Australia would
stand by our own to help and defend her to our last man and our last shilling.
After the outbreak of war in August 1914, leaders of all sections, for example, of Victorian public life met in the Melbourne Town Hall. After the Liberal Premier of the state had spoken in favour of Australia's aid for the mother country, the Labor leader of the opposition echoed his sentiments. He said,
"His cry was everyone's cry. My country, right or wrong. If they halted or hesitated, they would be less than Britishers."
And let's not forget that Irish Catholics, in numbers proportionate to their representation in the population, joined up to the first Australian Imperial Forces, the first AIF that went off to Gallipoli and the Western Front. Indeed, it might be said the war intensified the notion of British loyalty. In state after state, governments, quite often Labor governments, as in South Australia, introduced loyalty oaths which all students in public schools were required to recite. In the latter case, the students attested that
"I love my country, the British Empire. I salute her flag, the Union Jack. I honour her king, King George V, and I promise cheerfully to obey her laws."
And they continued to make such a pledge of loyalty until the 1950s. Now, these attitudes and initiatives were not prompted by British authorities. Britain itself had not adopted such loyalty ceremonies for their schools. They were introduced by governments elected by Australians under universal suffrage. Now, it is often suggested, as I'm sure many of you will be aware, that out of the blood sacrifice of Australian soldiers in the First World War, Australian nationalism was born. That the first AIF created a distinct and unique Australian myth. That Anzac Day, in effect, becomes Australia's 4th of July. Yet what was being celebrated was not a war of independence against Britain, but sacrifices made for the survival of the British race. The Return Soldiers Organisation, the RSL, which became the guardian of the Anzac myth, was and still is probably the Australian organisation most attached to the British tradition. It might be worth noting in passing, however, that Australian leaders resented the belated entry of the United States into the First World War. They decried the failure of their fellow Anglo-Saxons to come immediately to the rescue of the British Empire and their presumption in seizing the opportunity to challenge the British Empire's right to global supremacy. In the Australian view, Americans were not proper Anglo-Saxons. Robert Menzies, for example, who signed the ANZUS Treaty of Alliance in 1951 and who was to become Australia's longest-serving Prime Minister, after he visited for the first time the United States in 1935, he was Attorney General at the time, here's what he wrote in his diary.
"One thing which impresses the mind is that we err if we regard the Americans as our blood cousins. The majority of them are not Anglo-Saxons. Their language is by no means identical. Their appearance is different. Their ideas are cruder. Their standards are lower. They have no consciousness of responsibility for the well-being and security of the world. No sense of imperial destiny, except so far as it sounds in terms of collaring the world's trade."
Menzies was contrasting America with the British peoples and the British Empire, of which Australia was a proud member. In World War II, at the most critical period for Australia's national survival, from, say, December 1941 to May 1942, as Japan advanced towards its frontiers, the Australian Labor Prime Minister John Curtin, in a New Year's Eve speech, famously called on Australia to turn to the United States for help. As he put it,
free of any pangs as to our traditional links or kinship with the United Kingdom.
Some latter-day Australian nationalists have seen these words of a Labor PM as a decisive break with British identity and the beginning of a distinctively Australian one. But nothing could be further from the truth. The sentiments expressed in the speech were sentiments of expediency, chosen to meet a desperate situation when Australia's very survival was at stake. Curtin's first response to the attack on Pearl Harbor in December 1941 and the opposite of the Pacific War was this. It was to promise that
we Australians shall hold this territory and keep it as a citadel for the British-speaking race.
That was a phrase and national definition which he was to reaffirm again and again both in Australia and Britain. In London in 1944, he told the British that
in the Southern Hemisphere, 7 million Australians carry on a British community as trustees for the British way of life in a part of the world where it is of the utmost significance to the British-speaking race that such a vast continent should have as its population a people and a form of government corresponding in outlook and in purpose to Britain.
Now, these politicians knew their people. In 1947, after the Canadian government had decided that their people should henceforth be Canadian citizens instead of British subjects, a Gallup poll questioning Australians on whether they wished to be known as Australian citizens or British subjects found that 65% preferred to keep their British nationality. You will have heard there Curtin talking about the British-speaking race. Now, what on earth is he talking about? There is no British language. Nevertheless, that says something about Australia's sense of self in the era of mass nationalism. Australia's myth was not English, but British. It maintained, even in some incongruous way, that those of English, Scottish, Welsh, and Irish descent shared one seamless culture and one seamless history. And in Australia, where they were all mixed together, this was the race of people to which they belonged. So, since nationalism requires that each separate people had to have its own culture with its own distinct language at the core of it, Australians as a British people had to have a British language. And Chifley was to use that definition as well. So there you have it. Two Labor Prime Ministers of Irish Catholic descent are using this language. And don't forget, Curtin had been locked up during the First World War briefly for his opposition to conscription. Ironically, in Australia, the idea of Britishness had more relation to the social reality than it did in Britain itself. Indeed, Prime Minister Billy Hughes, also known as the Little Digger, on returning from Europe in 1919, told the Australian Parliament, he said, Australians are
more British than the people of Great Britain.
And as he put it, in contrast, the British Isles, he said, in Australia, it's possible
to go from Perth to Sydney and from Hobart to Cape York. We find men speaking the same tongue with the same accent. We are all of the same race and speak the same tongue in the same way.
Now, another question, of course, is where are all the kings and queens in all of this? Where's the monarchy? Since the British monarch remains Australia's head of state, and therefore, as with heads of state, generally is a symbol of the nation, it's worth looking at how Australians understood the monarchy in relation to this idea of Britishness. For the first half or so of the 19th century, republicanism was a respectable position in British and Australian politics. Even in Britain, for different reasons, some aristocrats, some liberals, and some radicals pushed the republican cause. But after 1870, as the monarchy was recreated as the symbol of the British people or race, republicanism in Britain and Australia moved to the fringes of politics. Criticism of the crown became criticism of the country. In other words, the British monarchy adapted to the age of mass nationalism. From the later years of Queen Victoria's reign to the first decade or so of Queen Elizabeth's, the hereditary sovereign was treated as a quasi-religious national figure and dressed up with all the pomp and ceremony of the British race's heritage. Queen Elizabeth's coronation in 1953 was, for most Australians who heard it on the radio or saw it on film, a profoundly moving ceremony. In the following year, the visit of the Queen, the first time a British monarch had set foot on Australia, evoked the greatest outpouring of public sentiment in the history of the country. It was reported that the crowd of 1 million which thronged Sydney streets, for example, was almost hysterical in its excitement. And the Sydney Morning Herald editorialised that the Queen symbolised the supreme achievement of the British race. And it reassured its readers that, quote, Australia is and always will be a British nation. Now, the tone of subsequent visits gradually changed from a sacred celebration of Britishness to a desultory curiosity about overseas celebrities. The so-called Bible of Australian bush nationalism, the Bulletin magazine said in 1954, wait for it, that the royal tour completes the nationhood of Australia. What is the significance of this British past for Australia's approach to its role in the world? Certainly since the 1960s, Australia's Britishness has been fading fast. Gone are the days when Australians were proud members of the British race. Nearly all the old British symbols have gone. Why has this happened? Firstly, it's a response to Britain turning its back on Australia and seeking its future in Europe. By that means, making the old ideas of a worldwide British people redundant. Secondly, it follows, at least in the post-World War II generations, an indifference, a certain indifference to nationalism itself. What I mean by that is that Australians over time have come to no longer have a need for the intense conformity and exclusiveness of that earlier national identity. Insofar as present-day Australians define themselves, with the occasional exception, it tends to be a rather low-key Australianism. And of course, from the 1970s and particularly from the 1980s and 90s, Australians have defined themselves as a multicultural society. And that, of course, is the very antithesis of nationalism. But having said all that, it has to be said on the other side, the impact of the British Australia era is still felt. You can see that in the AUKUS agreement. You can see it when Australia signs a free trade agreement with Britain. Some government ministers think this is making up for Britain's departure into the European community in the 1970s. A ludicrous position. But the British monarch still remains the head of state. And the head of state is not merely an empty form. The head of state is the symbol of the nation. And in 1999, when the Australian people were asked at a referendum whether they wished to keep the British monarch or to have one of their own as head of state, they voted to keep the status quo. And along with this, it's worth noting that with the British monarchy comes also a formal language which again seems at odds with a supposed Australian nationalism. Think of all the ABC reporters when the Queen died wearing black on television screens. Incredible. So it's worth noting too that all the ministers responsible for the making of Australia's foreign and defence policy are formerly ministers or servants of the Crown, not of the people. That's their official title. And symbols do have importance in the way that people perceive themselves and the world. Finally, how has this Britishness made Australians perceive Asia in racial terms? And what we need to look at here is the policy of white Australia. Australia's concern about its proximity to Asia contributed a further dimension to its self-definition as it evolved in this nationalist era. In addition to the anxieties of modernisation, were added the anxieties about the teeming millions of an alien Asia. And as a result, from the 1870s, the Australians not only defined themselves as belonging to the British race, but also to the white race. And in this search for a modern identity, culture came to be fused with colour. Australians define themselves as white and British. Now, in the whole Western world at this time, of course, ideas about race mixed freely with ideas about nationality. But in Australia, because of this apprehension about the looming presence of Asia, these ideas tended to take an absolute form. The European settlers' anxieties about Asia, at least down to the end of the 19th century, focused especially upon the issue of migration. After 1870, with the rise of the tensions related to modernisation, the colonists' fears about diversity and difference grew. And the appearance of Chinese, especially on the Queensland goldfields and the Northern Territory, created widespread alarm. Following a hurriedly convened conference of the colonial leaders, laws were passed, effectively ending Chinese migration. Now, unlike the laws that were passed by colonial parliaments in the 1850s and 60s, during the gold rush in Victoria, primarily, New South Wales, these laws now were not intended as temporary measures to meet a particular problem. They embodied a permanent principle, which expressed a new idea of Australian identity. Henry Parkes, in introducing legislation in the New South Wales Parliament, made it clear that these absolute provisions were needed to preserve what he called the British character of Australia. When in the 1890s an increasing number of Japanese began to enter the pearl fishing industry in northern Australia and to become indentured labour on Queensland sugar plantations, a more generalised alarm spread through the country. It was agreed that all coloured peoples of Asian, African or Pacific Island descent should be denied the right to take up residence or migrate to Australia. In 1901, the first major act passed by the Commonwealth Parliament was an Immigration Restriction Act, whose object, which was made perfectly clear in the debate, was to establish what George Reid, formerly the Premier of New South Wales, had termed a White Australia. Now, this legislation responded to an Australian view, a racial view of identity. In the debate over the Immigration Act, Prime Minister Edmund Barton argued that unless the Commonwealth kept out all coloured people, Australia would be eventually overwhelmed by immigrants
of an inferior race.
And he did not think that
the doctrine of the equality of man was really ever intended to include racial equality.
Attorney General Alfred Deakin, who succeeded Barton as Prime Minister, declared,
"We here are touching the profoundest instinct of individual and nation, the instinct of self-preservation, for it is nothing less than the national manhood, the national character, and the national future that are at stake."
The Labour leader, John Christian Watson, explained that the objection he had,
"The mixing of these coloured people with the white people of Australia lies in the main in the possibility and probability of racial contamination."
This idea of white Australia was, like British nationalism, a response to the crisis of modernisation, this psycho-social crisis that required an intense identity. It gave security through the defining of community in the most extreme way, a homogenous and conformist way, which demanded a monochrome and monocultural society. Australia's awareness of its geopolitical circumstances had produced an intense and absolute answer to the two questions thrown up by the era of mass nationalism. Those questions were, who are you and to whom do you belong and who belongs to you? So race and culture were equated, and by definition those of other races could never be assimilated. The admixture of the races would corrupt both. The ideal of a white British Australia was a foundation principle of the Federal Commonwealth established in 1901. Indeed, Keith Hancock, one of Australia's great historians, wrote approvingly in his 1930 seminal work, Australia, that
"White Australia was the indispensable condition of every other Australian policy."
And the White Australia policy was very successful. The founder's vision was fulfilled. By the mid-20th century, the percentage of Asians in the Australian population had shrunk to insignificance. From that time that the White Australia policy was passed in 1901 until the 1950s, no politician could call for its abolition and expect to be elected to Parliament. The experience in World War II of the Japanese downward thrust to Australia's very coasts had reinforced old fears. Prime Minister Curtin declared at the time that he felt intensely horror of a Japanese invasion because of the incompatibility of race and blood. And the Australian government in the immediate aftermath of the war embarked on a massive European migration program which aimed to guard Australia against a further onslaught from Asia. From the 1950s, however, the so-called White Australia policy came under attack from external critics, especially the newly independent Asian nations. And following a succession of small modifications, the edifice of the great walls of the policy, the great white walls of the policy, began to crumble, and in the 1970s, the policy itself was officially abolished. Like Britishness, White Australia, which was an equally powerful and widely shared foundation idea of the Commonwealth, has had an enduring influence on Australia's relations with the world. Some older Australians, it might be said, who are troubled by the rapidity of change in a modern society, still perhaps harbour a longing for the psychological security of the earlier era. But these are a small minority, as the ultimate failure of Pauline Hanson's One Nation Party shows. For the most part, Australians now no longer have a need, a felt need, for an intense national identity. And so they feel no need for a racially based immigration policy. The long-term consequence of White Australia is to be found, I think, in Asian countries who find the idea of a White Australia a lingering problem. In difficult times, it's used to embarrass Australia. The Malaysian Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad seemed particularly to enjoy this exercise. The antagonism incited by the memory is easily stirred, and in that sense, Australia, as far as some Southeast Asian nations are concerned, is still on trial. Now, in my next episode, we will look at how Australia came to assume the status of a nation state and to develop foreign and defence policies to serve the national interest. Thanks very much for listening. I would also like to acknowledge the Indigenous peoples for over 60,000 years who lived on, loved and dreamt about the lands on which I am speaking today. And I pay my respects to their present and future successors who continue to embody their affection for Australia and their enthusiasm for its well-being. This series is produced by Peter Adams for the School of Humanities at the University of Sydney.